You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Hi, welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Reporting from the World Science Festival Science
Street Fair.
Festival. Street Fair.
Yeah, and we are, with the rain just passed, and there's all sorts of exciting booths. And this first one we've stopped in at is the Museum of Interesting Things, which, as you can hear, has all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, we came over because there was a big vitrola sitting at the corner, but unfortunately it has signs posted on it saying do not touch,
and of course everyone's touching it, but we're not going to.
No one's cranking it, which is what I really want to do.
Oh yeah.
Oh, he's about to get cranked.
He's gonna get cranked. All right, here we go. Fun.
Who's singing? What is it?
I don't know. Right now we're under a tree because it's raining.
But we are still at the World Science Festival Science Street Fair.
We just thought we'd mention some of the events that we've gone to in the past couple days. We went to one called Madness Redefined.
Creativity, intelligence, and the dark side of the mind.
Which is not a Pink Floyd album. This was a panel with three scientists, researchers, or I guess professors. Ellen Sachs is a mental health law professor.
Kay Redfield Jameson is a psychologist.
And James Fallon is a neuroscientist. And this was, they started out, I sort of liked how they sort of started out by answering the question, basically they asked the question, okay, anecdotally and, you know, in all our stories and everything, there's always, people always talk about a link between madness or psychosis or depression, things like that, and creativity. And they sort of started out by saying, so, is there any evidence for this? And the short answer is yes.
Apparently, yeah. Although I, right from the beginning and right from the first time that I saw the title of this panel, I always have in the back of my mind the question of how do you really define creativity? In madness and what we would now call mental illness is hard enough to define, but then how do you define creativity? Because almost all human endeavor is creative in one way or another.
Indeed. They kept the term pretty broad. When they talked about the linkages in terms of what research has been done, they kept it relatively broad. I know that there are certain sort of psychological, not tests, but
tests of sort of outside of the box thinking.
Right, exactly.
Kind of mental puzzles that require a quote unquote creative answer. But this is why I have such a problem with it. So creativity, I guess, for the statistical studies that they talked about linking mental illness and creativity, they were using actual, I believe, the professions of the people who, in order to be considered creative, it seemed like they were counting people whose profession was art or music or theater or something.
Kay Jameson, she said that she referred to between 20 and 30 studies positively linking creativity and madness / melancholy. But she didn't go into detail about, like, all those studies, you know, how they define creativity individually and such like that. She used that just sort of as a broad statement to say that, yes, there does seem to be a link between them.
But in those cases, if they're empirical studies, it seems like it's almost a truism. to say that those who would be considered mentally ill, that is, their minds don't work in a normative way, it seems like almost a truism to say that their minds work in a different way from the rest of ours.
No, but different isn't necessarily creative.
No, no.
I don't
but,
know. I mean, if you're going to attempt to define creativity in this conversation, you're on your own, lady.
Well, the other studies that I was talking about, the statistical studies in populations, they also, I believe, several of them mention these. When there is a person in a family... Well, first of all, they looked at statistics of people who were diagnosed with mental illness and their professions and whether they were in creative professions. Mm-hmm. And they found... I remember it being sort of ambiguous what they found about people who actually are diagnosed in a sort of medical way as being mentally ill. But there seemed to be a clear link in family trees, the people who are related at one remove from to someone who has a mental illness were much more likely to be in creative professions mm-hmm. than people not, and people related at two removes were still more likely. But if you have mental illness in your family, you are more likely to be in a creative profession. That's mm-hmm. how I understood some of the statistics that uh-huh. James Fallon was.
Yeah.
And
he also had that interesting map of the brain, which made no sense to lay people like us because it had all sorts of lines and technical terms and everything.
Yeah, and but he didn't do a very good job of explaining it either.
No, he didn't. But the basic idea was that he was trying to show us how they have sort of identified parts of the brain that are involved in whatever creativity is, and then they also have recognized parts of the brain that are involved in whatever in bipolar disorder, and
yes,
he was saying that they've identified that they are connected, and that he used the term switches. He said we've identified the switches and showed that they are connected and that there is feedback between them, but we don't know which way the flow is. In other words, we don't know whether bipolarness sort of causes creativity, or whether if your creativity you're more likely to be bipolar, etc. They don't know the direction of flow.
No, but the switches that the way I understood what he said mm-hmm. was that they found, first of all, I should say that bipolar was one of the major disorders that they talked about as having distinct links to people in creative professions, that, mm-hmm. that is the one that seems to be most likely to be related to creativity, or to even sort of engender creativity, and in fact they suggested that a lot of the people in history, a lot of historical people who were said to have melancholia that we would today call depression were in fact low-grade bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
So what I understood Jim Fallon to be saying about manic depression was that they understand the switch that turns the brain from being depressed to being manic, and that same switch might switch on creativity.
I see.
That's how I understood it, but I would say that his explanation was brief, rushed, and a bit confused, and that the slide was taken down too quickly for
him
to get through.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. It was a small bit in a larger whole.
But I'm sure that one can look it up in his research. It seems fascinating. And do you want to talk about how he has a TED Talk available online? Maybe he.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things about this talk in general is that all three of these people are involved in either researching or in public policy and law or whatever. For these.
That duck call is from the Museum of Interesting Things booth behind us.
Yeah, all three of them are also. They are also diagnosed with things that they are either studying or dealing with as
yes.
professors. Kay Jameson is severely bipolar.
And Ellen Sachs is schizophrenic.
And, you know, James Fallon, they all told their stories, which was totally fascinating. Instead of us explaining James Fallon, like what his deal is with that, what we're going to do is we're going to link to his TED Talk where he tells his story.
Because it's a good story.
It's an amazing story, and it's really, you kind of got to see him tell the story.
Yeah.
So we're going to link to, that's going to be in the show notes. But both Kay and Ellen talked extensively about their experiences with their mental disorders and how they came over a long period of time to get them under control. Of course, largely, especially in Ellen Sachs' case, schizophrenic.
She talked about how she, in her earlier stages when she first sought medical aid because she was literally cowering in corners and thinking that she was killing people with her thoughts.
Yeah, and houses were talking to her. And I mean, I actually got a little choked up because, I mean, the time we live in, like this woman was, you know, 150 years ago, she would have been thrown in a room and the door would have been locked, probably, or something like that, you know? And here she is. She's on the stage, which she actually explained is not easy for her, but she is a professor. She's a tenured law professor, and her disease is under control. And, I mean, life is better for her than it ever could have been at any other point in human history, you know?
Yes.
And I get all verklempt.
However, it must be said that there was some discussion of how bad our modern American health system is for people with mental illnesses, and how the one thing that might have been better 100 years ago is that the traditional sanatorium where you could go and stay for months on an end in an idyllic place where there was a steady routine and everything was provided for you, that actually is what a lot of people with mental illness need. Real time
and structure
in a structured environment,
peace.
In a structured, calm environment,
right,
to get themselves back together. And that is the one thing that not modern science but modern society really does not offer,
right? Yeah,
modern stupid health insurance.
So it was actually a totally fascinating panel. Highly recommend going and checking out James Fallon's TED Talk.
And also, these will be available. The World Science Festival makes most of these panels available online at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And this panel particularly was interesting because I thought it was a really interesting choice to have all these scientists whose personal lives and professional lives are so intertwined.
Right. It was also, as a skeptic, I really enjoyed the fact that there was a lot of anecdote, fascinating stories about their own lives, except they are also all experts and provided evidence for most of their claims and stuff. So that, I appreciated that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can hear that sound in the background. That's over at the Pop Bottle Science tent. Sounds like a lot of popping.
What is happening here?
What we thought was the pop bottle science sound is actually several tables worth of children hitting things with hammers.
They seem to have leaves of various trees that they are hammering between wax paper, so they're probably making leaf imprints.
Ah, yeah.
That is my hypothesis. However, I don't think I'm going to test it.
Well, here we are again, taking another little rain break here.
If there's any thunder in the background, it's from the sky.
As opposed to where? Where else does thunder come from? Some really bad jokes are possible.
Talk about that second event that we were privileged to attend, which was Reawakening the Brain.
Through music.
And it was mostly an interview of Oliver Sacks.
Who is adorable.
Of course he's adorable.
I know, we all knew that he was adorable, but
it was really a pleasure to see him.
We had really
him.
Good seats.
We did, yes.
So,
we were press.
Yeah, that's right. And so he recounted stories and talked, you know, he sort of did his Oliver Sacks thing, told some stories, many of which you've probably heard if you've seen him speak. Or
they showed some clips from his documentaries over the years, which were totally fascinating.
Yeah. Some of the interesting things that he said that I didn't know about is that he talked about working with a music therapist in 1966.
Yeah.
Which is way earlier than I thought music therapy was around.
Yeah, there was a prominent music therapist also on the panel later. Be quiet, birds. Who mentioned that music therapy was started in 1950.
Oh, in 1950, yeah. Though he did, Sachs said that music therapists in 1966 was unusual.
And but it was a much more sort of primitive idea at the time.
Right. So, and then another thing he said that I found interesting is that science was on to the science was clued in to the odd connections of language and music and non connections as early as 1870. He said there was a doctor who noted that some speechless children could still sing. They couldn't speak, but they could sing. Back then, they didn't yet have the tools to figure out, you know, what the hell's going on, as we are now figuring out, slowly. But I thought that was interesting. He also just recounted some of the, you know, sort of stories from Reawakenings and, Awakenings. You know, his book was made in the movie.
Yeah.
And
some of the clips that they showed from the documentary that inspired his book and also the movie with Robin Williams, which was that called Awakenings?
Yes. Or
was it? So they showed some of the clips of the deeply locked in stroke patients and the Parkinson's patients who could barely move or had sort of very small repetitive movements and couldn't control their movements, and they showed some of the things that Oliver Sacks talks about in his books, things like some of them have reflexes left, such as catching and throwing a ball.
Right.
These people who apparently cannot even pay attention to anything outside them, suddenly when a ball is thrown at them, they catch it with perfect coordination and throw it back.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable to see.
But none of that had to do with music. And then also he showed some clips of the early trials of L-DOPA.
Mm-hmm.
And showed them in the first flush of the effects of L-DOPA, where these, once again, nearly paralyzed patients would sort of leap out of their wheelchairs. One woman after 43 years.
Mm-hmm.
So those were incredible, and I'm sure those documentaries are available.
Somewhere.
Yeah, definitely worth watching. But none of that had anything to do with music.
No. Then they brought out a prominent music therapist whose name is
Concetta Tomaino.
Yeah. And she was very interesting. She, you know, I found interesting that the transition between Sachs to her was a video, I don't know what it's called on YouTube, but I know it made a lot of rounds on Facebook not that long ago, the Henry video of the elderly man who is barely responsive to anything.
Then Alzheimer's patients.
Yeah, patients. Listen, I don't think they said he was Alzheimer's. They did? Okay. So he's barely responsive at all, and then they play him one of his favorite pieces of music, and he starts singing along, and then afterwards he actually answers some questions and such. So it's a totally fascinating video. And then they brought out this music therapist, and she and the host of this event referred to that as music therapy, and she said, well, just to clarify, that video is not showing music therapy. Music therapy is then what happens after that video, once the music has helped to open him up a bit, and then, you know, then the therapy begins, which I thought was interesting.
Yes, what she said was that is an example of a person experiencing music, and you're seeing the effects of music on an individual, but that is not therapy.
Right, right.
There was a third bobcat that went by, interrupting our podcast.
There was a third participant on the panel.
His name was Peter Janata, and he was a cognitive neuroscientist. And he actually was talking about some of the... They very nicely, once again, balanced this panel with the famous Oliver Sacks, who is a clinician and works with patients using music as part of his therapy, and then Concetta Tomeno, who is apparently a giant in the field of music therapy and directs a lot of the happenings in music therapy around the world. And then they had this cognitive neuroscience scientist who looks into what happens in the brain during the experience of music and music therapy. So right. It was a great three perspectives on music therapy and the effects of music on the brain.
Right. One of the things he said that surprised me a little bit was he said that humans are the only mammals who respond to beat.
Yes, and then he very carefully reiterated mammals because right. There is apparently a cockatoo.
Right, which many of you have seen on the on the internet. There are other birds too.
It seems that especially songbirds can respond to rhythm right. In a way that's similar to humans, but that we are the only mammals
who coordinate
our movements to a beat.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting. I would have figured, I'd never seen it, and now I know why, but I would have figured you could do that with a chimp somehow, but apparently not really.
And I know some of you are going to say the elephants, the elephant orchestra.
Oh, yeah, but that's...
Because there's apparently one elephant in the elephant orchestra who does seem to coordinate to a beat, but it's not standard. It's not a standard feature for elephants.
Right.
There seems to be that one.
Well, also, there's a difference between repeatedly stamping on a tambourine or whatever the elephant does and hearing a beat and coordinating your movement to it, right?
I don't remember.
I mean, the elephant orchestra isn't exactly the most
But I thought that one elephant did experiments with that one elephant to see if it would synchronize to an existing beat.
Well, clearly we should stop talking about it and come back to it in another episode because we don't know, right?
If you're out there listening, Dave Soldier... We need to talk to you about the elephant orchestra. But we were talking about how we coordinate to a beat. And some of the other things that were asked of the cognitive neuroscientist were... The answers were a little bit imprecise. One of them being, of course, where is music in our brain? And the answer is very difficult to say. It
right.
seems like it's in many places. And one thing that he kept reiterating in response to this, the insistent questioning from the journalist who was from the host of the discussion, was that it's all over in our brain, and it seems to be a matter of coordination between various parts of our brain and feedback loops between various parts of our brain
right.
that lead to the phenomenon of music and to the experience that we have of music. And then there was some suggestion that maybe this is why music is a useful therapy for people who have various brain damage or cognitive dysfunction and even physical dysfunction, because music engages so many different parts of the brain
mm-hmm.
at once, and it can engaging one part that is somehow connected to a dysfunctional part can help to reestablish
connections
and function to the damaged part.
Right.
And those were a lot of the cases that they were talking about. It was completely fascinating, of course.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Now, the last participant was the guitarist Stanley Jordan. Now, the World Science Festival often has a sort of artistic component tied in with their different panels and events and such, which, of course, as artists, make us happy. But Stanley Jordan did not just play guitar. As it turns out, he is training to be a music therapist as well.
Yeah.
And...
Has been for some time. He's doing it slowly amidst the rest of his career.
Yeah. So it was an interesting panel. It was a delight getting up close with Oliver Sacks, who's just so cute. Did I say that already?
He's adorable.
Yeah.
It was a good panel. And the World Science Festival has been really great this year.
I agree.
Slicker and calmer.
Well, slicker, not in a bad
organized.
Way, though. Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't. I mean, more polished, perhaps, I should say.
Yeah.
So thank you to everyone who has made it possible. Thank you to Maki and Nicole for inviting us to do this. And thank you to Brian Green and Tracy Day for putting it together. And to all the funders,
mm-hmm.
without whom it could not be done.
Thanks to human beings.
I feel like almost like we're a radio show.
No. We're a podcast. Don't you worry.
Thank you, all of you, for listening, and I hope that some of you enjoyed events in the World Science Festival.
Is this a vinegar and baking soda experiment?
Seems like it.
Similar. We missed the intro. And the caps are popping off the vials.
So, thus ends our little tour to the street
World
fair.
World Science Festival.
Street fair. The tour.
World Science Street Fair. World Street Fair. It's the end of the World Science Festival.
Science, the Street Fair.
The end of the world.
The world is
Science
ending.
Festival.
Through. No, wait. Thanks for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
From ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We don't have our notes in front of us. So.
But you know the usual venues through which to give us reviews, feedback.
Go to the website, get the
insults,
things and the stuff.
Random quotes.
We're not scientists. We're musicians. And until next time.
Thanks for listening.